TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. It was and is possible to stop nuclear power plants. From TUC Radio's archive, here are 10 examples of closed plants and as many good reasons why.
The proponents of nuclear power now claim that nuclear power plants need to be brought back in order to prevent global warming. The Nuclear Information Resource Service responded to that claim by stating, "Nuclear power is not emission-free. From uranium mining, milling, and enrichment to construction and waste storage, nuclear uses fossil fuels. Nuclear power plants are also cost prohibitive. One reactor takes 7 to 10 years to build. Reactors cost $4 billion or more each a decade ago, and the price hasn't gone down. Devoting scarce resources to shore up nuclear takes away from the real climate change solutions, conservation, energy efficiency, and renewables like wind and solar. KDRI has worked on hazards from so-called routine releases of radioactive gases and waste from nuclear power plants. In 1976, she chaired a statewide campaign in Missouri that resulted in the cancellation of a nuclear reactor already under construction. Here is Kay Dry.
In the 30 years since my first public speech on nuclear power, that is, against nuclear power, I've asked many questions, read many documents, and have consulted with many experts in the field. The result has been an even greater bias against nuclear power. My favorite reason for disliking nuclear power is that workers are exposed to radiation at facilities throughout the uranium fuel cycle, from mining through the handling of the waste. My second favorite reason is what brings me here today, the fact that every nuclear facility releases radioactive waste to the environment as a part of its routine operation. It does not take an accident. I remember when I first learned about routine releases. I was walking toward a public meeting at the Callaway nuclear plant, under construction at the time in Missouri, alongside a farmer from Kansas who was fighting the proposed Wolf Creek plant near his farm. He told me there would be a vent in the reactor building and that radioactive gases would be released to the atmosphere through the vent. I had known that the walls, roof, and foundation of the reactor building were to be built of thick concrete, reinforced with steel bars, and assumed that they were designed to completely seal the radioactivity inside. However, I found out the farmer was right. The reactor building does have a vent. I had often read that a core meltdown plus a break in the containment building would let radioactive gas into the atmosphere. What I had not known is that the building comes with a break in it. That is, a vent for the release of gases, including radioactive gases. In fact, nuclear power plants cannot operate without regular, deliberate releases of radioactive water and gases. The releases from the reactor building are needed to control the pressure, temperature, and humidity, and to keep radioactivity from exceeding government limits for workers. The vents have filters that stop some of the radioactive gases from being released. However, no filtering technology exists for some gases, like xenon-135, which decays into cesium-135, an isotope with a 2-million-year half-life. Certain gaseous and liquid wastes leak or are intentionally removed from the reactor vessel or the steam generators or the irradiated fuel pool during a plant's routine operation. When these waste products are present in concentrations below the alarm set point of the radioactive waste system, the waste can be released to the river or other cooling water source without detection and therefore without reporting. So no one really knows how much is released. Noble gases, tritium, and other fission and activation products can be released to the atmosphere. Tritiated water, dissolved or entrained noble gases and other wastes can also be released to the river. I remember being amused when I learned that certain fission gases like xenon and krypton are called noble gases because they don't mingle with or form compounds with the hoi polloi. Therefore, while radioactive gas is accidentally or intentionally released to the atmosphere from a plant building, are routed through high-efficiency particulate absolute or HEPA filters before being discharged to the ventilation stacks, noble gases can just pass right through the filters. Tritium, or radioactive hydrogen, can, too. A vent is located not only in the domed roof of the reactor containment building, but also in the auxiliary building, the radioactive waste building, and the turbine building. The plant's routine operation includes two types of planned gaseous releases, both venting and purging. To vent a building, a valve is merely opened. To purge a building, a fan is used. In addition to the typical containment building unit vent that may be operated an average of 2 to 4 times a year, newer nuclear power plants have small diameter purge lines, about 8 inches in diameter or less, that can provide a continuous purge while the reactor is at power. To return to chemically inert noble gases, while it is correct that noble gases may not readily interact chemically with other materials, they can physically interact. If inhaled or swallowed, noble gases can cause physical harm while passing through the body or if entrapped within it. They give off physical energy as radiation in the form of particles and rays. The radiation is able to penetrate body tissues. The physical energy of the radioactive particle can change the structure of DNA, just as when a car that is standing still is hit by a car in motion. If the particle mutates a gene that produces an enzyme that is not particularly vital to the cell's machinery, the damage may not even be noticeable. On the other hand, if it mutates a gene important to cell function, very serious manifestations can occur, particularly cancer and other life-shortening diseases, including circulatory, respiratory, muscular, reproductive, and immune system disorders. In addition to the many shorter-lived radioactive gases generated at nuclear power plants, one that is of particular environmental concern and that is produced in high yield in nuclear power reactors and weapons is krypton-85. It has a radioactive half-life of 10.77 years. The krypton-85 that is generated in a reactor today will continue releasing beta particles for at least 10 half-lives or more than 100 years. As with the plant's gases, not all radioactive isotopes can be filtered from the water. No economically feasible technology exists to do so. Tritium, or radioactive hydrogen, for example, cannot be filtered. A great deal of tritium accumulates in a nuclear reactor, both as a fission product that leaks out from the fuel and by the absorption of neutrons by the boron additive in the cooling water. Just as water containing ordinary hydrogen and oxygen is a component of all living cells, tritiated water, a major byproduct of nuclear power plant operation, can also be incorporated into all the cells of the body. Many laboratory studies have shown that long-term chronic exposure to even low concentrations of tritium is more damaging than previously believed. Some of the hazards resulting from tritium uptake include mutations, tumors, and cell death. Other radioactive isotopes are also released to the environment without being filtered when they are at a concentration below the level the plant monitors are set to detect, a level the government has decreed to be acceptable. But acceptable does not mean safe. It means as low as reasonably achievable. In other words, as low as the industry claims it can afford to achieve. Radioactive wastes are produced by the fissioning of the uranium and by the neutron activation of corrosion products or rust in the reactor coolant system. I'd like to mention the first technical word I learned when I started my study of nuclear power. It was CRUD, the name given to the corrosion products in the primary cooling system. It was created as an acronym for Chalk River Unidentified Deposits, referring to the extremely radioactively hot and dangerous rust that was first found at the Chalk River plant in Canada following an accident. The corrosion products in a reactor become radioactive when they are bombarded by neutrons. They accumulate on the piping, fuel rods, valves, steam generator tubes, and even on the walls of the reactor vessel itself. Some of the activation products that slough off into the cooling water escape past the particulate filters and end up being released to the environment. The rust that builds up in the steam generators, that is, in the secondary cooling system, are not called crud. They're called the green grunge. These corrosion products, it's very hard to find humor in this field, you know. These corrosion products also clog up essential cooling equipment and give off highly penetrating gamma rays that place welders and other workers at great risk during the repair and replacement of leaking components. To give a sense of how much radiation is emitted, one repair of corroded components at Indian Point 1, about 25 miles from Times Square in New York, took 8 months and required 700 men in order to stay within the radiation exposure regulations. A similar repair effort in a conventional power plant would have taken about 2 weeks, not 8 months, using 25 men, not 700 men. In order to try to reduce the radiation fields in which workers must repair defective equipment and to make the reactor operate more efficiently, solvents are often used, including chelating agents that dissolve the highly radioactive crud. The chelating agents form multiple bonds, making them very persistent in nature. They are able to keep the dissolved radioactive rust in solution, increasing its mobility in the environment potentially for many decades and beyond. When wastes bonded to chelates are buried, they are able to migrate out of the trenches into the groundwater and the uncontrolled environment. Unless the plant's liquid radioactive waste containing chelates are kept isolated from the rest of the waste, the dissolved waste can become a part of the waste stream that is released into the river, lake, or ocean. Since the chelates are non-biodegradable in nature, the crud bonded to the chelates remains dissolved and highly mobile. The buildup of crud at reactors nationwide and the resulting increase in radioactive waste will obviously increase within the older plants, for which operating licenses have been extended to a 60-year duration instead of 40 years for which the plants were designed. When I initially began reading about nuclear power, I accepted the claim that the heated pressurized water in a typical reactor circulates in a, quote, closed loop, that is, from the reactor vessel into some 22,000 thin-walled steam generator tubes in order to generate steam to run the turbine generator, and then goes back into the reactor vessel. But I gradually learned that the closed loop is not completely closed. Proponents of the increased use of nuclear power like to say that no air pollutants are released from nuclear reactors. That just is not true. Radioactive waste are released into the air and water as a part of the routine operation of every nuclear power plant.
That was Kay Dry, former board member of Beyond Nuclear.
The next speaker is David Freeman. David Freeman has dealt with nuclear power plants and public utilities all his life. An engineer and lawyer, he was energy advisor to President Jimmy Carter. He held top positions at the New York Power Authority, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, Lower Colorado River Authority, and the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. During his tenure in Sacramento, David Freeman initiated the nation's most intensive utility conservation program, including electric vehicle, wind, and solar programs.
The title of my talk is What the History of Nuclear Power Tells Us About the Future. It tells us to forget it, for God's sakes.
That's my talk. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not going to let you off that easy. I think the label for the industry's program is trying to make success out of failure. I have never seen a technology fail as miserably as the nuclear option has failed. And the word that comes to my mind is chutzpah. How can they possibly have the nerve to come to the American people after decades of failure? And I'm not talking as a kibitzer or somebody who's been in the academic world writing papers about this. I have been there. I've experienced it. And I will tell you about it. But first of all, the word guilt hasn't been mentioned here. And we have to recognize that this whole atomic energy program, Atoms for Peace and all, was born out of the guilt that the people had in dropping the bomb. Remember, the State Department spread this all over the world. Everybody had their little Atoms for Peace program. I remember when I went to Israel in 73 to talk them out of building a nuclear reactor. They told me, well, Ben Gurion said that a modern state has to have atomic energy. And that was kind of the mindset. I myself is a young civil engineer working for TVA in 1949, applied for TVA's nuclear program. I wanted to go to Oak Ridge. It was considered the cat's meow. When the first light water reactors were built at Oyster Creek in the late 60s, Milton Shaw, who was in charge of that program, told the AEC that they weren't ready yet. But GE was ready to start selling them, and the NRC overruled him and made a certificate of practicality or whatever it was, and we were off to the races. I had the misfortune of inheriting an armada of 14 nuclear reactors when President Carter named me to head the Tennessee Valley Authority. I'm proud of the fact that on the basis of my vote alone, we shut 8 of them down while they were in midstream. And then I buried one out in Sacramento when I took over the Sacramento Municipal Utility. People that have had experience with nuclear power have acquired a little bit of wisdom on the subject. TVA neglected all of its other power plants and just built nukes one after another. And it would have been broke if I hadn't shut the ones down. There was a historic meeting between me and Senator Howard Baker. The breeder program was getting in trouble in the Congress. And Senator Baker, who was from Tennessee, I was the head of TVA, called me into his office and said, Dave, I want TVA to take over the breeder program. It was located in Oak Ridge and was in our service area. And in my characteristic way, I said, well, Senator, does that mean I'd have to testify in favor of it? He said, Dave, I'm serious. I said, well, Senator, I'm serious too. I said, I couldn't testify in favor of it. He just shook his head. And, of course, we didn't take over the breeder program, and it died. So I played a little bit of role in seeing to it that the marketplace and the cost overruns and everything put an end to that failure. The light water reactors failed. Nobody has bought one for over 20 years. The breeder program failed. The whole program has failed. Now they're coming back, and it just boggles my mind. Here we are in an age of terror, and they want to put radioactive Trojan horses into our country. Now, the only benefit we've gotten out of this nuclear revival program is it has brought a number of conservative people into supporting the global warming issue. This increased interest in Washington, I think, is a almost direct result of a bunch of conservative Republican people being lobbied by the nuclear lobby to support the idea that global warming is serious. So I give them credit for that. But that doesn't mean that we have to be stupid enough to go down that nuclear rat hole again. I mean, the arguments, let me just summarize them. They've been said here again, but I think putting them all together is important. The risk of a nuclear accident, everyone agrees, is more than zero. That's too much. Because if you have a major accident, it's going to kill and cause cancer to huge numbers of people. The risk from the day-to-day dosage coming out of the nuclear plants is more than zero. It's unacceptable. There's no threshold. We have the proliferation impact. How can we preach to the rest of the world not to go down this trail if we resurrect it and go down it ourselves? We become extreme hypocrites. It just ties our hands on trying to contain nuclear proliferation. It's definitely not economic. I mean, that's very clear. It's been demonstrated. But there's another factor about the economics. I once had a conversation with Ken Lay about nuclear power. Ken Lay is, of course, the greatest proponent of the marketplace that ever hit this world. And he said he'd never buy one. And I said, well, why? He says, because the lead time is 5 or 6 years, and I don't build speculative power plants. I have no idea what the load's going to be 6 years from now, and in an era of deregulation, there's no way a sane capitalist would buy a nuclear power plant. And he's right. It's only in a monopoly situation, in a socialist environment like France, or an extreme monopoly with a lot of subsidy, that you would even think about it. And it takes a police state to live with it. And think about that. So, you know, we have a list long enough to choke a horse of reasons not to do it. And then there's another reason. And I can say this as a guy that's run a half a dozen major utilities as a CEO or the chairman of the board. The opposition to nuclear power is a fact. And if you're a CEO and you're contemplating what kind of power plant to build, you will go for a solar plant 10 times in a row before you'll go for a nuclear plant once, because you can't be sure that you can get the sucker built. And democracy is alive and well at the state level, most of this country. So that dog's just not going to hunt. We have to really look at this energy problem, though, and recognize that there's got to be an answer. There's got to be an answer to our dependency on imported oil, and there's got to be an answer to the growing terror of global warming. And we need to recognize that the answer has to be broader than just the electric power field. The electricity is about 20-some-odd percent of the energy business. There is the transportation sector, and then there is the whole heating and industrial use that natural gas supplies. And if we're really going to deal with global warming, we've got to recognize that there's as much carbon going in the air from the transportation sector as there is from the electric power sector. And there is just one answer that I know of that will cure both, and that is to harness the renewable energy resources on this earth. Renewable resources is gigantic compared to the coal or the gas or the oil. And they're delivered here on earth free of charge by Mother Nature. And, you know, talk about chutzpah. That's the fusion program. The idea that we are smart enough to where we're going to duplicate the heat of the sun here on earth, contain it, and make electricity out of it after trying for 55 years and not reaching scientific feasibility. And we won't put a nickel into harnessing the sun that's delivered rather diffusely, I know, but delivered, spread all over the earth pretty much, and delivered free of charge. The solar power and the wind power, supplemented by geothermal and biomass, is super adequate. And the technologies are there to make electricity out of it and to use that electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen and pipe that hydrogen all over. And we can have a hydrogen economy based upon renewable energy. It's just that we've got 160 IQs working on a 130 IQ problem. We've got very, very, very bright people who've got to really think of a hard way to do things and a complicated way to do things, because the scientific world thrives on that. We want to conquer the scientific Mount Everest. You get somebody, a physicist out of school, they don't want to work on just implementing some technology that exists. They want to learn how to tame fusion power. And so we go on pouring billions of dollars into the hardest thing we can do, and we're not implementing the technologies that we know that we can do. I mean, we've got to start recognizing that we need to work on this problem as though our lives depended on it, because they do. There are some solutions that we ought to be for, and that one of them is not nuclear power, and that we do not need it in order to solve the problems. That we can harness the renewable energy sources. And the biggest source of all is what Arjun and I put on the table back in the 70s, which carried the day for this country for 15 or 20 years, and that's efficiency and conservation. We can save through investments in efficiency. I'm not talking about human behavior. I'm not asking people to turn the thermostat up or down. I'm talking about investing in equipment that will utilize energy more efficiently, like more efficient cars and others. We can dramatically reduce the demand, and then renewables can meet not only the growth, but they can reduce our use of fossil fuels. And let me just ask you to think a bit. If the world doesn't change immediately, if everybody in the world knows that America, at least, is going to be using less and less oil each year rather than more and more, we would not be debating about screwing up the Arctic wildlife. That wouldn't be a debate if the demand for oil was going. And let me just say a couple of things here before I finish. The technologies are there. The internal combustion engine loves hydrogen. We don't need to wait for the fuel cell. This is brainwashing that's gone on by the automobile industry and the Bush administration. They have a lot of intelligent people using the fuel cell and hydrogen as though they were Siamese twins. No. Hydrogen at 5,000 PSI has been determined safe by all the people that have in tanks that have. We'll improve the product once we get going, but we could launch a Manhattan-type effort to harness the sun and the wind, convert it to hydrogen, pipe the hydrogen to where it's needed, and build the infrastructure on our highways. When Henry Ford built the T-model, we didn't have any damn roads, and you bought gasoline in a drugstore. This country is still capable of doing something to save our lives, and a program to harness the renewable resources on this earth, convert them in a form that can run our transportation system as well as our electric power system, and in time even replace natural gas. And it doesn't cost five times as much to use solar power. We can firm it up with the hydropower in our systems, with load management techniques that I've employed. I've run electric systems, and we can integrate these intermittent resources, but their main use don't have to be in electricity. Their main use is conversion to hydrogen and running our transportation system and being used as heat. The perfect is the enemy of the good. We have good solutions. We need to implement them as though our lives depended on it. Thank you.
That was David Freeman, recorded in November 2005. He has managed water and power utilities in Tennessee, New York, Colorado, and California. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.